And go ahead and take a seat. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have three matters that are scheduled for oral presentation this morning, July 31st, 2024. Attorneys, you've been here before. A reminder, 15 minutes each for presentation of your case. Excuse me, appellate counsel, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Also, because we record and stream these hearings, please remember to state who you are and which party you're speaking on behalf of. And with that said, I'm going to ask our marshal to call the first case for consideration.
Now, hearing case number 824-0215, Absolute Sport Cards, LLC versus Matthew Thornton.
Good morning. May it please the court and the counsel. My name is Rod Sheeta, the attorney for the appellant in this matter, Mr. Matthew Thornton. Of course, this case involves a LLC and Mr. Thornton's status as a minority member. He made some claims that he was frozen away or out of a business. Ultimately, trial court essentially ruled in favor of ASC on every claim, it appeared. We raised a number of issues in our brief, essentially five issues. I guess I'd like to focus on a couple of those today. I think the main issues in the case are probably the court's finding that the original operating agreement was manifestly unreasonable in the manner in which it allowed competition in section 11.5. And of course, the other issue that I think is basic to this case is the backdating of the expulsion. And of course, I'd like to get into both of those issues because I think if those are legal errors, and we're suggesting they were.
All right, let's start with the determination by the trial court that it was manifestly unreasonable. Here's what I struggle with. You've got some inconsistencies in there. So why do we not agree with the trial court that you have internal inconsistencies in deciding what can happen and how that plays out? I mean, to me, that seems to follow the logic of the trial court in dealing with this matter. Explain to us how we should overcome that.
Right. Well, I think we have to look at the contract because that's what the court decided was manifestly unreasonable. It clearly allowed these pre-existing businesses to operate. There was really no limitation there on scope or otherwise or timing. Nothing said about, oh, people are liquidating or something. So the contract was very clear. So
but then isn't we need that, to me, though, what you just said, how broad that exemption is, how open-ended, how it's not limited by time, no other restrictions. I mean, isn't the breadth of the purported exception in and of itself irreconcilable with the very broad non-compete provisions of Section 11? Well, that's what I'm struggling with.
Right. That, well, I think it's of an exception. I mean, I don't think we have to get into the broad language of the non-compete. We have an exception, so it doesn't need to sort of clarify what's up above in the operating agreement.
But doesn't this exception swallow the rule, and isn't that sort of the manifest, isn't that what makes this provision 11.5 manifestly unreasonable?
It does not, because we have some case law, of course, this was found after the trial court process, but we have the Lamy decision, I believe that was in New Jersey, under the same statute, revised uniform Limited Liability Company Act.
Did Lamy involve the situation we have here where you had broad non-compete language in the operating agreement and then the exception or exemption like we have here? I can't see it from reviewing the Lamb opinion. That's why I'm asking you if I'm missing something.
And maybe it didn't matter to the court. I mean, I think it's such a broad holding that, look, these clauses, these provisions are actually good for business. They've been well received by investors and so forth. And of course, they cite a couple of secondary authorities.
But are you talking about the Lamy case now?
Correct.
Yeah, the Lamy case that says any business. I mean, I think that's what I was following, is that it's very broad and saying no business is. You can do any business. And here, your case, you know, we're talking about the cards, the sports cards.
Yeah.
So isn't that a distinction that would?
Not based on the record we have here. I mean, there's no evidence that ASC brought in an expert. Oh, this is a niche business. I mean, what does that really mean? I mean, maybe McDonald's would claim they're a niche business. I'm not sure that
they have done that. Is that a failure as far as the at the trial court end?
I'm sorry, did...
Well, you're saying it was a niche business. Should that have been explored? Is that something you're saying was deficient as far as their response?
I don't see anything in the case law that would you know, make it, you know, meaningful or worthwhile to, for example, remand it to the trial court to develop that issue. There's really nothing in the case law. It's very clear. And what I'd like to point out about Lamy, and maybe we sort of glossed over it in our brief, they had the exact same statute. Right, it's the revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act. It seems like in various states, like this has different language. It has the exact same language.
Other than Lamy, which is a non-precedential opinion from a different state, is there anything else that you found that's closer to home, meaning here in Minnesota, that would support your position on that?
I would say, I don't know if it's closer to home, but we've cited the Texas decision. I think that's maybe the second most important, maybe on par with Lamy. But nothing in Minnesota, but I haven't found anything, you know.
Do you think there's any reason Minnesota court should consider the appellate court specifically a precedential opinion on this particular case matter?
Well, I think this is certainly, you know, it's not just the Lamy judge did this and we should just do what the Lamy judge did, right? They cited some rationale for it, some secondary authorities and that kind of thing. And again, we have the same statute, and I hope I don't miss this point. If I say anything today, it's the statute in Lamy was, I think, you know, 42:2C-11D1C. It is the exact same statute we have here, which
but, is... But isn't the point not so much what the statute says, because I agree with you, but whether the terms of the particular operating agreement, a term is manifestly unreasonable. That turns on the operating agreement, not necessarily not the statute, right?
Well, no, I think it turns on both, but I mean.
But what makes, arguably, what in Lamy, what the court said, it's not manifestly unreasonable because, and it based its decision on the language of the operating agreement, correct? In determining whether it was manifestly unreasonable.
But it really, it pointed out the statute and said, how could this be manifestly unreasonable? It's actually permitted by the statute.
This is my question about your argument, do you disagree with the district court's interpretation of the statute, or do you disagree with the district court's application of the statute?
I disagree with its sort of interpretation and application.
So what's the interpretation problem with the language, how the district court, because it, you know, if you're asking for a precedential opinion, we have to interpret the language of the statute. What issue do you take with the way that the district court interpreted the statute as opposed to applied it in this context?
Right. So, and I keep coming back to the statute, I apologize, but it's the same language in
but
Lamy.
Do you see the district court as interpreting the statute differently in Lamy as opposed to applying it in a different way?
Yes, the trial court here missed the statute that was used in Lamy. It completely missed it.
And that's subdivision 8? Is that what you mean?
It's actually the one I just cited in New Jersey. So the comparative provision here is 0.0110, subdivision 4.1, triple I. It's really a meandering kind of thing. It's an exercise. You have to look at the statute, and you have to kind of go up here, and then you go down there. But it basically, it's a double negative. You may restrict or eliminate the duty. Then you don't go down below to refrain from competing, right? So it's the double negative, which makes section 11.5 perfectly fine. And ASC has cited nothing in any case law that this wouldn't be treated.
But if we're just reading the sentence, it all starts with if not manifestly unreasonable, which means that you can have a term that is manifestly unreasonable that has a clause under sub 4.1.3.
I think it could still be...
So if the inquiry is whether it's manifestly unreasonable, then don't we move down to subdivision 8? I guess is my question. Or if the argument is that the term is manifestly unreasonable, don't we then move down to subdivision 8 as opposed to moving from to sub part 3?
I see
little eyes.
And I see the sort of the Lammy Court sort of looking at it all at the really the almost simultaneously, not really one before the other. It's basically, how can this be manifestly unreasonable? Why would we really get there if competition is permitted in the way that it's being done? So if it's permitted, it clearly is valid and not what might have been manifestly unreasonable.
Does that read out the if not manifestly unreasonable portion of the statute? What is your interpretation of the if not manifestly unreasonable language at the beginning of subdivision 4? If what you're saying is as long as it's articulated in 1I, 1, 2, and 3, it's not manifestly unreasonable, then what is the meaning of that phrase at the beginning of subdivision 4?
I mean, anything could conceivably be manifestly unreasonable. However, when you look at the case law, when you look at 4.1 triple I, we cannot simply say that competition by itself is manifestly unreasonable, even if sort of broad in scope or time, because we have the case law. I like the Irwin Cruz decision. It allowed, under not the exact same statute, but you could open up a brand new business that the other LLC members didn't even know about. Wouldn't that be a lot more manifestly unreasonable than what happened here, where the parties actually agreed?
But it's the term that's got to be manifestly unreasonable, right? Not necessarily what the facts are. But that's what I'm struggling with, and I think I'm asking the same question that Judge Larson has expressed, and that is, it seems like this is sort of a circular thing. I mean, the fact that there is this exception, which, which there can be an exception, but the question is whether this particular exception is manifestly unreasonable when given the circumstances of the operating agreement at the time it was drafted. And my question gets back to, how do you reconcile this broad exception with the even broader non-compete provision of Section 11?
We could completely disregard Section 11. It is not part of the exception. The exception is there for a reason, clearly. We don't need to read Section 11.
So why are there both provisions then? Are those two reconcilable?
Right. Well, I mean, it's like, you know, you could have a provision that said, you know, there are, let me just maybe put it a different way. I mean, I think that when we look at these two decisions, that on its face, competition by itself is not manifestly unreasonable. If this contract in 11.5 had said, Mr. Thornton can engage in his pre-existing business, but nobody else can, then I might have a problem with it, and maybe then, you know, it would be manifestly unreasonable. But there's no case law that says that these exceptions are somehow just by themselves manifestly unreasonable. So Mr. Thornton, I think, wins either way. Whether we have to stop and say under 4.1 triple I that this is permissible, or we get into the issue of manifestly unreasonable, because at the time, right, and we can only consider the time, the circumstances at the time of that contract, they all agreed to this.
They were all winding up. They had all been operating in the same space, right, as independent businesses. And the whole idea was they were coming together to form something new with the notion of we're all going to wrap up, right?
Well, boy, that's pretty scary position when you have a contract that you've signed off on. You have an integration agreement. Mr. Thornton argued very well the parole evidence rule, and all that was set aside. So what we'd be promoting is, just go ahead and freeze, you know, folks out if things sour. You know, don't go to court because, you know, in the end, you know, if you were justified in freezing someone out, I guess, under some theory, then, you know.
If I may,
yeah.
Only because your time is really running down, can you address the expulsion issue? I mean, you're arguing both that it was not authorized by the operating agreement, and then you're arguing the retroactive application.
Thank you. So I think that when we look at the statute, it doesn't allow for that backdating. Now, we can get into the reasons why you would never backdate in this case, because Mr. Thornton, all he was doing was following a contract that we now see is pretty common and accepted, you know, across the nation, at least in a couple states, and no evidence that it's not. But if we look at the statute, we have the Jacobs Cattle decision from Nebraska, where it was a little bit different, but they said, no, you can't backdate it because the language is present tense, right?
What about his expulsion in the first place? Does that need to be governed by the operating agreement, or is the conduct that was perceived by the other two enough to expel a member?
Well, there was nothing here that would justify expelling Mr. Thornton, but since the expulsion didn't occur until 2022, he really need not make a Magna Carta argument, I guess, about that. Because at the end of the day, if the retroactivity was wrong, then he's part of this LLC all the way into 2022. He gave an evaluation of the company in December 2021. So really, whether the expulsion, we don't believe it was proper. It was not proper. But the retroactivity is the bigger problem, because if in fact we should value, or his disassociation occurred when the expulsion order took place, I think that gives him what he needs. And the entire complexion of the trial court's ruling on damages, lost profits, valuation, all that changes, because it was all infected by the manifestly unreasonable decision and the retroactivity decision. Thank you.
You'll have your rebuttal, as I stated. We'll hear now from respondent counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Adam Galili, and I represent the respondents, Absolute Sports Cards LLC, as well as its two owners, Clint Wolson and Michael Hansen. The court's familiar with the facts of the case, so I'd like to skip those and just address some of these issues. I think your honors understood, listening to your questions to opposing counsel, on how the statute should be read. And the district court, when it comes to the issue of manifestly unreasonable, first started by saying, these are the first words in the statute. They must mean something. They must limit something. There must be some situation that exists that the legislature had planned out that would allow the court to find that something is manifestly unreasonable. So the argument that, well, the contract says what it says, that's not good enough. There's an exception here, and the exception is if the court finds that it's manifestly unreasonable, then it doesn't have to enforce it.
And what is it about 11.5 that is manifestly unreasonable and was at the time the operating agreement was created?
Your Honor, I think that's a great question. If we look at subdivision 8 of that statute, it'll identify how we define manifestly unreasonable. So what events at the time, the circumstance existing at the time, and then the court should look at, was the objective of the term unreasonable, or was the term unreasonable to achieve its objective? Your Honor's comments previously, I think, touch base on this. There's ample testimony on the record that the three owners, these three individuals, got together. They had separate businesses, and the agreement was, we're going to wind down and combine our inventory. We're going to take all our assets, put it together, and sell out of one storefront. And so that existed, I believe, at the time of the signing of this operating agreement, and I believe there is testimony as to at least one of the owners, Michael Hansen, already founding a storefront, already transferring his inventory into that storefront. The second owner was in the process of winding down his store, Mr. Wolson, and the only individual that didn't is the attorney that drafted this agreement, Mr. Thornton. And so I do believe that while the district court may not have cited the subdivision 8, I do believe that they looked at the circumstances that existed at the time that this term was executed, at the time of the operating agreement. They looked at the party's behavior at that time and their intention. And the court found that based on that, this term was objectively unreasonable. It would be unreasonable, the district court found, to allow unlimited and unfettered competition in the exact same industry, in the exact same type of memorabilia, in the exact same type of store. Everything between Mr. Thornton's store and Absolute Sports Cards are the exact same. They sell the exact same in the same market and in the same state.
Is the problem with 11.5 that it is unlimited in duration? Is that the problem with it? Explain to me why the term itself. I understand the background, but what is it about the term of 11.5, the terms of 11.5, that make it, at its inception, manifestly unreasonable?
Your Honor, I think that's a great question. I think it's the objective of that term. If that term had been limited, had been limited durationally, where it allowed the parties to wind down their store and compete for X amount of time, I think it would potentially not be manifestly unreasonable. But the way it was drafted was that it would allow to compete forever and ever. And you combine that with the facts that the other two owners are pouring their inventory and even the sales of Mr. Wolson's inventory as he was winding down, he returned that, he put that money into Absolute Sports Cards. So even as he's winding down and selling his separate inventory, he's already acting under this operating agreement that we combined our assets, and what's mine is now ASC's.
Isn't really, I guess what I see as a potential distinction from Lamy is it's not clear from that opinion that there's this conflict between provisions where you have sort of the non-compete provision and then you have the exception to the non-compete provision. And that if you just didn't have the, if all you had was the exception, then we would have a case like Lamy, which is we're going to start this business, but we're all just going to continue to compete with each other. Then you wouldn't have, to me, where I think that this case is distinct from Lamy is that there's the tension between those two terms. And I think that the district court also saw, do you agree with that as sort of the point at which the court is making that distinction, the district court was making that distinction?
I do, Your Honor, yes. I do agree with you on that analysis. I do. So
I have a question with regard to the backdating issue, because I don't know that the statute is entirely clear that it is giving the district court authority to backdate when this expulsion happened. Could you give me your sort of, you know, most clear statutory interpretation analysis under 0602 for why the district court has authority to backdate? And obviously, I know that you rely on the holiday decision, but it would just help me to know, like, what precisely you would point to in the statute for what gives the district court authority to do the backdating.
I need to add to that inquiry, if you will, because that bothers me also. The district court here found that there was persistent and uninterrupted competition. And in making that finding, it appears to me that your clients should have done something before instead of waiting. And it just bothers me that it seems like, well, they didn't do anything. So where are they at in it? So if you can take my question and join Judge Larson's, let's just talk about the backdating.
Yeah, maybe we should talk about backdating.
I will do my best. I think first the backdating, the provision that's applicable there, I believe is 5, which says on application by the company, the person is expelled as a member by judicial order, and then it goes through the list. So first I would say that language is not limiting. It doesn't say as of the date of judicial order. It just says by judicial order. If the legislature intended the date to be, as counsel said, the day the court issues the order, my argument is it would have made that clear. And so I think the language by judicial order doesn't mean as of the date of judicial order, but by what the judicial order says. I think as to the second question of why did they
wait? Can I just ask one statutory and then you can go back? But so then what is your response to appellant's argument with regard to the word when and the meaning of the word when at the beginning of 602, at the very beginning of 602? It says they're disassociated from the LLC when. And I think that they're hanging their hat on that when means at the time of the judicial order, that somehow creates a temporal limitation. At least that's how I understand their argument.
I guess my counter would be I don't know how else the legislature would write it, I guess, except just taking out when and putting a colon in. You know, if it read from a limited liability and then just a colon, I don't see that when as limiting.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry, yes. I'll let you get to Judge Berkman's question. I just wanted to give you a chance to respond.
So you would say when means circumstance as opposed to a temporal?
Yes. Yeah. The question of why did they wait so long, I
don't know if it's fair that they didn't do anything. I mean, if their conduct is kind of saying, well, we know you're doing it, go ahead. I mean, you can interpret it as that.
Right. Well, I think it did take some months for Mr. Wolson to wind down his store. I think the district court said maybe, you know, 6 months or so. So now we're into about the middle of 2017. I do believe that there is testimony that the partners had approached Mr. Thornton prior to that. I do think the court could have potentially expelled him as of the date of the operating agreement. I don't necessarily think it had to be that 2018 date. I think the court found that 18 date by looking at the equity, by looking at the facts and the circumstances and what would be fair under that situation. And the court looked at the fact that that was perhaps when the partners officially kind of said enough's enough.
Well, that at that point, the partners had recognized willful and persistent conduct by the appellant.
Correct. I think there was also hope on the partners that that Mr. Thornton would slowly start to wind down and would start to transfer assets even between late 16 and some point in 18. They saw that this is not happening. He's continuing to sell. And there was testimony from experts on, at the time it was a plaintiff side, Absolute Sports Cards, that Mr. Thornton was one of the top five competitors in the business. This isn't just, you know, it's not an oversaturated market with a lot of competition. And this brought the issue, the 20,000-foot issue here. I think that the district court did a great job analyzing is how can you allow someone who is a member of an LLC, and being a member means you owe some sort of duty, how could you allow that person to directly compete with another LLC of which he's a member and owes a fiduciary duty?
Well, because 11.5 says you can.
Well, right. I guess piggybacking off of that, I do think that there's sort of this weird nuance here where I don't think that you disagree that the other members were competing with this business for at least some period of time at the beginning of the creation of this LLC. And so creating this backdating when 11.5 existed in the contract until the district court said that it didn't. There seems like a factual nuance here with regard to this backdating that's different than maybe your traditional case of you have this non-compete provision. All of a sudden, the other members realize that there's competition going on, and then you go to the district court, and the district court says, yep, they figured out that you started competing on this date, and we're going to backdate to when you started competing. There is sort of a weird nuance here where I think 11.5 is a provision until the district court said it wasn't. Isn't that what the law would say? Or do you think that the law is that once it was determined manifestly unjust, it was always manifestly unjust, and therefore all of the members were violating the contract from the beginning of the operating agreement?
I think there's probably a balance to be drawn there. I think it's a great question. But I think from the other side of it, Mr. Thornton knew that the other two partners had combined their inventory, and he knew that the intention here was to combine the inventory, yet he continued to sell. And the district court makes a finding that even after the summary judgment motion in which it invalidated 11.5, he continued to sell in direct competition.
But then why wouldn't the backdating be from the motion for summary judgment when that term got invalidated as opposed to the date that got selected?
Because I think the court looked at the parties' behaviors prior to that, starting like at six, even before the signing of the operating agreement, and through the date that they said enough's enough, hired counsel and filed a motion. I also think the question of expulsion as of, let's say, August of 18 versus 2016 wouldn't make a difference as far as the damages. The damages, the share value that the court found was based on the operating agreement. And so whether it was, even if it was 2022, the district court's logic was still, these parties never updated Schedule 3 of their operating agreements, which says their shares are worth $25,000. So no matter which date we pick, the district court's analysis was his share, Mr. Thornton's share, is worth $25,000, and that would be the buyout. Your Honors, finally, the issue of election to continue versus dissolution, I just want to touch base on that very quickly. 322C.0701 gives the court authority. A remedy other than dissolution may be ordered in any case where that remedy would be appropriate under the facts. This is in Part 2 of Subdivision 2. There's two sentences. The first sentence only applies to proceeding brought under Subdivision 1, parenthetical 5. But the second sentence allows the court in any case, not just in a case brought under the prior subdivision, to bring a remedy that would be appropriate. It's the broad equitable powers of the district court, and the district court went into several layers of analysis as to why it has the authority to do this remedy of involuntary transfer, essentially, of Mr. Thornton's share. The court found that there was no harm to Mr. Thornton. He was getting his money either way, whether it was via dissolution or whether it was via an involuntary transfer, he would receive his shares. The court found it would not be equitable to Mr. Wilson and his partner to now dissolve the company, which they had been, you know, jointly putting their blood, sweat, and tears over the past 6 years at that point. And so the facts warrant the district court forcing the involuntary transfer versus dissolving and forcing the Absolute Sports Cards to suffer due to Mr. Thornton's actions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. So we got two kind of competing arguments here. ASC's is, let's have a holding where we just freeze people out when things go south for a company, oppress the minority member. I mean, we talk about equity. This is really punitive for Mr. Thornton, extremely punitive ruling. All for, when we look at his conduct, what was it? He was following a contract that would later we would see in other case law is more than arguably acceptable. Is that a basis for what the trial court did here? Absolutely not. And if ASC had a problem with this, they can go to court. Because when you have an issue concerning the duty of loyalty to not compete, that's exactly when you go to court under 0502. And that's why ASC went to court, right, was to get the expulsion, to disassociate him. And the disassociation occurs when, on application, which is a prerequisite, of course, to that order, the person is expelled. So under the statute 645.08, present tense cannot include the past. It only includes the future.
I understand your argument. I'm looking at, what are there, 14 different events that can cause disassociation, and the judicial expulsion is unique in that it requires a court order. But it also, that subdivision 5 references willful or persistent past conduct. So doesn't that support the district court's assessment that it's not just the time the court actually orders expulsion, but that there is significance to when the underlying conduct that leads to the expulsion occurred, in a way that these other 13 disassociation grounds aren't linked to both conduct and an action by the court? How do you respond to that?
It's only linked to a court order because Jacob's Cattle, same kind of language, the present tense, they said, we can't read that other stuff into the statute. We can't do that, right? Because we have present tense language. That's not our job as the court, right? So the present tense means something. And so that's the way I would answer that, is that you can't read something into the statute that's not there.
And when you say present tense, are you referring back to the when language?
I'm referring to the when, and then on application, and then is expelled. I think the biggest word there is when, because what's preceded by the when? The disassociation. That's what's supposed to cut Mr. Thornton off of being a member here. So that's the when we should be concerned with. So we have a choice between freeze-outs and following the statute and going to court and getting an order. And wow, what a really inequitable result for. And I have to push back a little bit. This exception in section 11.5, we can't render it superfluous. You know, I think the retroactivity is maybe the bigger issue, but it can't be manifestly unreasonable. We can't say that this contract, where everybody signed off on this contract, and the trial court. Thornton did not discuss or explain the document to them thoroughly. They admit only skimming it because as non-lawyers, they did not understand most of its contents. The sweeping language preserves arguably no opportunity for any member to compete. Wilson testified that Thornton had not pointed out that provision. Thornton, quote, conceded he alone drafted the document. How is that relevant that Mr. Thornton drafted the document? There's no ambiguity in it. Section 11.5 cannot be written out of it. It cannot be considered superfluous.
Can I go back? Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, can I go back to the backdating issue? I have two hopefully short questions. Is your argument that you just cannot backdate, or do you also argue that the district court picked the wrong backdating, or do you argue both of those? Let me clarify. Do you argue that the district court picked the wrong date in backdating, or do you only argue that they're not allowed to backdate at all?
Maybe there's a sliver of an argument that you could maybe on application go to court, get a temporary injunction or something like that, but that really didn't happen here, right?
Yeah. And then my other question, it would be helpful to me if you would respond to respondent's argument that if you'd picked a different backdate, it wouldn't have changed the buyout amount. Do you disagree with that?
Between 2016 and 2018?
I think he said 2022.
Oh.
Time has expired, but answer the question,
thank
please.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sorry.
I don't think we can pick a previous date prior to the order in a case like this. If in another state, like Holiday v. Story with the old statute, it was listed occurrences, right? Here we have the very clear present tense language as to when dissociation occurs, so we can't backdate. Thank you.
Judge Bjorkman, did you have a question? All right, thank you. Thank you to both attorneys for appearing today and arguing in support of your written documents. They are helpful. The matter is deemed submitted, and a decision will be issued in the 90 days.
Thank you.